work any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal, where I want to begin with a series of events where we have Joe Biden blasting Donald Trump for purported election lies and blaming him for the Capitol riot. It's really pretty stunning stuff because it's so completely detached from the truth. For Biden, it was a very emphatic speech. His acting ability was in great demand here. In a fiery address from the Capitol, President Joe Biden gave his strongest defense of democracy. Yet, to mark the anniversary of the January 6th riot, directly attacking former President Donald Trump as a defeated liar and an outstanding threat to the country's founding ideals. Now, let me just observe, you're witnessing in action a party that's projecting and accusing its alternative, its opponents, of the very actions of which it is most disgustingly responsible. There's no question about it. This is completely outrageous, has no basis or foundation in fact. We have Kamala going even further, likening the January 6th riot to Pearl Harbor and 9/11. Vice President Harris kicked off the Biden administration's remarks on the first anniversary of the January 6th riot by comparing it to the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1941 and the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. Certain dates echo throughout history, including dates that instantly remind all who have lived through them where they were and what they were doing when our democracy came under assault, dates that occupy not only a place on our calendars, but a place in our collective memory. December 7, 1941, September 11, 2001, and January 6, 2021. This is completely absurd. Just contrast, more than 2,400 Americans died at Pearl Harbor, nearly 3,000 died in the 9/11 terrorist attack. Harris, who participated in a Black Lives Matter protest outside the White House in May of 2020, just hours after rioters attacked police around the building, injuring dozens, assaulting journalists, forcing the evacuation of the president into a bunker declared of the Capitol rioters. What they sought to degrade and destroy was not only a building, hallowed as it is, what they were assaulting were the institutions, the values, the ideals, the generation of Americans that marched, picketed, and shed blood to establish and defend. The whole thing's a complete farce. They're blaming Trump for inciting an insurrection. But as David Marcus pointed out in The Federalist, there's no legal foundation for this claim. Not even ordinary language supports it. The Democrats and their media allies are trying to convince the American people that President Trump is guilty of inciting an insurrection. In both legal terms and the plain meaning of the English language, their claim is absurd on its face. There are two fundamental reasons for this. Trump did not incite the riots at the Capitol, and the riots were not an insurrection. The standard for incitement, legally speaking, incitement has an incredibly high bar that none of Trump's actions since the election come close to meeting. These standards were set by the Supreme Court in its landmark Brandenburg versus Ohio case. Among other points, the decision held that to constitute incitement to violence, speech must include intent and specific, not abstract, instructions to act. It also requires a speech in question would likely produce imminent lawless action, which went a step further than the previous legal test for incitement. This is just outrageous. I listened to Trump's entire speech. It was very general, nonspecific. It encouraged people to protest the theft of the election, which was 100% appropriate, but to do so in a peaceful, respectful fashion. The ellipse was a mile and a half away from the Capitol. It would have taken those who were there 30 minutes or so to make it over. So the idea of imminent lawless action is frankly absurd. Moreover, this was no insurrection. So much for incitement. As to insurrection, at no point was the overthrow of the government of the United States even a remotely possible outcome. Not even close. Those close-blown idiots taking selfies in Speaker Pelosi's office and parading around with podia had no intention of forming a new government. This was an expression of anger, not a realistic organized coup attempt. Anyone among the rioters who believed their actions would result in the overthrow of the government, if there were any, were delusional to the point of insanity. So if it wasn't incitement and it was insurrection, why do the Democrats, the corporate media, and the big tech tyrants want you to believe it was? It's quite simple, actually. The purpose is to create an atmosphere of crisis and emergency, gives cover to extreme and illiberal actions to punish and silence those with whom they disagree politically. I believe, in fact, there's a deeper, more malevolent motive at work here, which I shall shortly address. Meanwhile, we have the Attorney General Merrick Garland, who's about as despicable a clown as we've ever had occupy that office, declaring there's no higher priority for the Department of Justice than charging and prosecuting those involved in the January 6th Capitol riot. And they are doing that and pursuing that in gross violation of elementary legal principles. They're holding them without trial, without having to giving them an opportunity to consult lawyers, without putting them out on bail for what are, for the most part, completely nonviolent crimes, really as trivial as trespass. The Justice Department, claims Garland, remains committed to holding all January 6th perpetrators at any level, emphasize at any level, accountable under law, whether they were present that day or otherwise criminally responsible for the assault on our democracy. We'll follow the facts wherever they lead. He went on to say, those involved must be held accountable, and there is no higher priority for us at the Department of Justice. As of Wednesday, 725 persons had been arrested and charged. Of the 725, 325 with felonies. The department is still searching for 250 who allegedly assaulted police officers. His remarks come as prominent Democrats question the efficacy of Garland and his investigation. Former Democrat Senator Claire McCaskill, for example, warned if Garland does not charge former President Trump, he could go down in infamy as one of the worst attorney generals in the country's history. Moreover, Garland uses speech as an opportunity to promote voting legislation congressional Democrats hope to pass. They want to use the upcoming January 6th observance to push their voting legislation packing through Congress. Notice, he says at all levels. McCaskill says, charge President Trump, even though we know there's no legal basis for it. But then, this is a lawless administration. The Department of Justice is not following the Constitution. This is not about the law. This is politics. Garland vowed the DOJ would do all it can to protect voting rights and called on Congress to pass a legislation which indeed is intended to federalize elections and to make it the case that the Democrats can continue to steal elections into the future as they did in 2020. So Biden and Harris now are using the January 6th to demand a federal takeover. The vice president referred directly to the multiple Democrat-led bills that would federalize local and state elections and overturn election security laws passed around the country. Here in this very building, a decision will be made about whether we uphold the right to vote and ensure free and fair election. Let's be clear. We must pass the voting rights bills that are now before the Senate, or we're going to go down to defeat. We've been massively cleaned our clock by Donald Trump, first in 2016, then in 2020. We had to take extraordinary measures to steal the election in 2020. We want to do everything we can to preclude Donald Trump from running for office again. That is what's going on here. Biden presented himself as a defender of democracy against the mob fueled by Trump. I will stand in this breach. I will defend this nation. I will allow no one to place a dagger at the throat of democracy. We will make sure the will of the people is heard and the ballot prevails, not violence. Mind you, this guy is a complete and total fraud. He's not cognitively competent. He's not even the real Joe Biden, as I've explained many times before. Meanwhile, Democrats are quietly exploring barring Trump from office over January 6th. This is what it is all about. The Democrat Party, constitutional scholars, and pro-democracy advocates have quietly explored the possibility of disqualifying former President Trump from holding office again in the years since the January 6th attack on the Capitol. After the riots, there was a crescendo of calls to take steps to strip Trump of eligibility. Since then, they have abated. Participants in the 14th Amendment discussion say that discussions have nevertheless continued about applying Section 3. Let me read it to you. Amendment 14, Section 3. No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, but Congress may by a vote of 2/3 of each house remove such disability. That's what this is all about. This is why Nancy Pelosi orchestrated the events of January 6th. That's why she refused the offer of then President Trump to provide military security for the event. She did not want military security. She was acting in concert with the FBI. They were bringing their operatives, their informants to the scene in order to manipulate and stage an orchestrated event that could then be held against Donald Trump because they're petrified given his gigantic political standing with the people of the United States, that he's going to wipe them off the map again. And I think that's a very legitimate anxiety, but the techniques they're using are completely immoral, illegal, unconstitutional, undemocratic betrayals of America on a scale heretofore never seen right in the United States, with a possible exception, of course, of those who orchestrated the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the key player being none other than Lyndon B. Johnson, who'd gained more personally than anyone else by ascending to the presidency himself, and those who were behind 9/11, where it appears clear that Dick Cheney was the executive director operating from a bunker beneath a White House, where Michael Rupert, in his brilliant book, Crossing the Rubicon, based upon publicly available sources, zoomed in on Cheney as having the key executor of a plot that was originated by Ehud Olmert and Bibi Netanyahu, two prime ministers of Israel, to find a way to draw the United States into the Middle East to take out the modern Arab states that served as a counterbalance of Israel's domination of the entire region and eventually to confront the Persian nation of Iran. And it worked like perfection up to the point that the democratically elected president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, invited Russia and Iran to send troops to the defense of the nation, which they did and put a halt to the absurdity. Mind you, Iran is still being targeted by Israel and by the United States, which has what you could describe as a Khazarian foreign policy. I have no doubt that in the broader scheme of things, this man is nothing more than a puppet. He appears to have had his strings pulled initially by Barack Obama, but ultimately I believe it's the Rothschild banking empire that has control over big pharma, the mainstream media. How endlessly have I reported that our major networks are dominated by dual U.S.-Israeli citizens, CNN. I have a panel of 100 executives, all of whom are dual U.S.-Israeli citizens, NBC. Again, a panel of 100 executives, all of whom are dual U.S.-Israeli citizen. And then from the New York Times, a panel of 100 executives, all of whom are dual U.S.-Israeli citizens. Which means that the Rothschilds, really, who claimed the responsibility for founding Israel and who, through BlackRock and Vanguard, own Big Pharma, really are controlling the whole operation to bring about the great reset that will enable them to seize control of the entirety of planet Earth. It's an audacious plan that is as massively corrupt and tailing as it does murder, genocide on a scale the world has never seen as its mechanism for implementing. Lawrence Tribe, whom I used to think was a responsible scholar at Harvard, has observed, if anything, the idea of using the 14th Amendment has waxed and waned. I hear it being raised with considerable frequency these days, both by media commentators and by members of Congress and their staffs, some of whom have sought my advice on how to implement Section 3. Well, if Lawrence Tribe thinks Section 3 could be implemented against Trump for having incited an insurrection, then he doesn't understand the law, which disqualifies him even from his position at Harvard, where now, of course, no doubt he's emeritus, as am I, from the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota. But this is grotesque that he should be offering advice in a situation where it's clear there is no justification. In a new report, Democrats, lawmakers found around a dozen have discussed in public or private how Section 3 might apply to those who took part. Jamie Raskin of Maryland on the January 6th committee, Jerry Nadler, chair of the House Judiciary, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, of course, are among the offices that have spoken with Tribe recently. I continue to explore all legal paths to ensure that the people who tried to subvert our democracy are not in charge of it, Wasserman Schultz told a reporter. Remember, this is the Wasserman who had a Pakistani ITEC guy spying on members of Congress under her cover, who was so concerned as the head of the DNC at the time they'd lose as many as 11 House seats in Florida alone, that she arranged for the Parkland shooting to distract attention, where they claim the March for Our Lives, which occurred a few weeks later, had been based upon the event on Valentine's Day, February 14th. But in fact, the Metropolitan Police Department and the Mayor's Committee for Major Events that involved closing roadways in Washington, D.C., required a permit to be submitted 180 days, that's 6 months in advance, which they did. They had hundreds of products, shirts, coffee cups, all that. Many have observed it would take longer to arrange a bake sale at a local church than it has set up this mass event involving all kinds of major players on the streets of Washington, D.C. It was not, and we have confirmed and proven beyond any doubt, even the officer who processed the application acknowledged it had been submitted months in advance and that months of planning had gone into this event. During the impeachment trial, by the way, Raskin served as a House manager during which Trump was accused of being responsible for the January 6th attack. In a press conference following his acquittal, he talked about the constitutional provision, saying Trump is in the bullseye of that group. The point is that the constitutional purpose is clear, to keep people exactly like Donald Trump and other traitors to the union from holding public office. While the ones who should not be holding office are Jamie Raskin, Jerry Nadler, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, these are the traitors to the nation, not Donald Trump. This is completely absurd. According to the report, most constitutional scholars say the provision is not self-executing. Thus, to make the 14th Amendment effective for Trump, Congress would have to take an additional step. Scholars believe that Congress, upon a simple majority vote in both chambers, could find that Trump was engaging in insurrection on its own, thereby implicating the Constitution. Allowing Trump back into office would then require a supermajority vote under the 14th Amendment. In the view of other experts, such as Tribe, Congress needs to go further, either by creating a fact-finding body neutral to the Trump administration or assigning a fact-finding role to the federal government. After Trump's Senate impeachment trial last February, Representative Stephen Cohen introduced a bill permitting the Attorney General to claim that an office holder violated the provision and should be barred from holding future office before a three-judge panel. Besides legislative discussions, other efforts have focused on pressure on state election officials so they could be sued privately. They wrote to chief election officials in all 50 states and Washington, D.C., urging them to prohibit Trump from appearing on the ballots of future elections. As a result, the group claims Congress doesn't have to take any additional steps since the 14th Amendment is already in effect. Just as states are permitted, if not required, to exclude from the presidential ballot a candidate who's not a natural-born citizen, hey, what about Barack Obama, who is underage, who has previously been elected twice as president? So, too, states should exclude from the ballot a candidate such as Trump, who previously swore to support the Constitution but then engaged in insurrection. The group's letter to the Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger stated, but what if election officials refuse to comply? We intend to litigate this question, the group's president, John Bonifaz, said. So if a Secretary of State does not follow the mandate, we will bring this matter to court. Some scholars, however, believe such lawsuits would likely face serious hurdles and be challenged in the Supreme Court. If a Secretary of State declines to find Trump ineligible, it is far from clear who could challenge that determination, explained another law professor, Gerard Maglioka of Indiana University, where, by the way, I earned my Ph.D. States differ in their laws regarding ineligibility. The outcome of any lawsuit over his eligibility in 2024 would likely depend on whether a congressional fact finder had already determined that Trump's role in the January attack triggered Section 3. In its absence, a lawsuit brought by Trump to challenge his exclusion would be more likely to succeed. That's why we have the January 6th hearing taking place. What the January 6th House panel ultimately reveals about Trump's role, therefore, may impact the possibility of pushing for his disqualification. Once that committee makes clear, as I trust it will, Tribe says, knowing it's a foregone conclusion because the whole committee is stacked, the evidence they hear is not going to be any that exonerates Trump, not even legal points that we've already had explained from the Federalist, that what took place was indeed an insurrection, that triggers Section 3 of the 14th and supports criminal prosecution and by DOJ of those responsible. It is difficult to imagine this not becoming the logical next step. Of course, If Democrats were successful in banning Trump from holding federal office, it remains to be seen how half the country would react. An actual insurrection could take place, not the fake one that satanic Democrats equate to as being on the same level of the September 11, 2001 attacks. I think that's a stunning indictment of what's taking place and how Pelosi and this panel are operating in a completely lawless, undemocratic fashion. Let me add a few words more before we have the break and I introduce my guest for today. We Americans are now in a cold civil war. Despite Joe Biden's promise of unity during his 2020 presidential campaign, the administration has failed to unify the people. On the contrary, his divisive rhetoric means Americans are more polarized than ever. There are those who even speculate about a map as to how the nation would be divided. But since the parts of the map are not contiguous, there's a great center-south part that is red, and then west coast and east, blue, and some states in the middle, including Michigan and Wisconsin and Illinois. It would be very difficult to see how this could be arranged. Not only that, but would they then have their own army, their own Air Force, their own IRS, their own Supreme Court? I think the idea of secession is a fantasy. On the other hand, I do believe Americans have to stand up for the democratic process, which the Democrats are violating. Indeed, they ought to rename themselves the Totalitarian Party, because they're employing methods and techniques that would have made Joe Stalin proud. Remember, by federalizing the election, it'll make it easier to steal subsequent elections again and again and again, where the evidence, the proof that that is taking place is abundant and detailed and compelling in all of the states, and where I have been simply stunned. I continue to be gobsmacked that the Supreme Court declined the Texas case submitted on behalf of the states of Pennsylvania, Georgia, Michigan, and Wisconsin for violating their own protocols in determining the electors that would be sent to Washington, D.C., where Mike Pence ignored his responsibility, declined the election was in dispute, and it state verification.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey everyone, it's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? that the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities, and that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs, but there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
Revolution Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomsteps.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, I'm very pleased to have a highly unusual guest from a very unusual location. He comes from a very proud geographical location. He's sitting on an unceded land of the Mi'kmaq people. Cape Breton Island is the birthplace of commerce and mercantile trade in North America. Lewisburg was the first fortified stronghold and the entrance to all of North America. The French and the English battled for this strategic maritime location. He has been living through the globalization of this small island and wants to share with you what has been taking place. Glenn Muse, by name, I'm so pleased to have you as my featured guest today. Join the conversation.
Thank you very much, Jim, for having me. I'm sitting on the unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq Nation in Canada. We are the only nation in North America that did not bend the knee to the king. We only pledged allegiance to the Pope at the time and called him uncle. So their Grand Chief Membertou was responsible for keeping an eye on the activities of the church in Cape Breton and did a fantastic job, as we never went through the tyranny that everybody else incurred. My name is Glenn Muse. I'm a proud descendant of Irish, French, and Mi'kmaq. That makes me an Acadian. 250 years ago, there was a genocide in the maritime provinces of Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Newfoundland, and Prince Edward Island. If you want to take a shot and take a look on the map, look for Maritime Canada and have a look at what I'm going to tell you. Cape Breton Island, Isle Madame was a French, Portuguese, English settlement. John Cabot came here and found codfish that were the size of a 6-foot human. And they began the first trade from North America to the British colony in Europe of the cod. The cod was salted, and it was shipped back in the hulls of these ships. The Portuguese came They set up colonies in Newfoundland, Cape Breton. And at that time, over in France, during the early 1600s, the Huguenots were purging the Catholics. And my descendant, my great-great-grandfather, grand-père, his name was Philippe Muse d'Entremont. Now, d'Entremont was the name of the individual in France who granted title to Philippe Muse to come to Nova Scotia in 1655. He came here, 1616. He came here and he married a woman of the Mi'kmaq Nation. Her name was Marie Baptiste. And from there were 16 sons. These 16 sons grew to be healthy men. And all of them were trained in the ways of the Acadian people, which became a distinct generational culture and ruled the maritime provinces up to 1755. Now, there were major things that were taking place here. Louisbourg, as mentioned, Louisbourg was a very fortified place. And in order to get to Louisbourg, you have to look at the shipping patterns of the day. When you launched a vessel from Europe and you caught the trade winds and you caught the Gulf Stream, naturally it would take you right in to the Louisbourg. It would, if you set your boat up in England and Spain, and you come riding in, it was a normal place to land. And it was deemed the hub of everything that was going on for the French and the English at the time. Now, we were accustomed to living with the Mi'kmaq, so we learned everything from the Mi'kmaq. So the Acadians thrived, but the genocide was committed against us, and we were shipped all over the world to Haiti. But the majority of my people were shipped to Louisiana. They were shipped down into, because they were famous for their works with dikes, and they were famous for their works in that area, they were sent down to Louisiana. They thought that the alligators might eat them, but you know what? We ate the alligators, and we came back here. And we set up shop again, and we had alligator boot stalls, and when we got back here. So all of my family was dispersed around this small island of Cape Breton. Now, Cape Breton Island is so unique in what I'm going to build up to with the globalization that you have to understand its position in history. Now, when they set up shop here, the English and the French, they kept on beating each other up all the time, and they were mostly beating each other up. So my people were just sitting back watching, and we headed to places that the British couldn't get to. On the island, there's a northern tip you'll see on the northwestern top of Cape Breton. There is a natural occurring wind there called, we call it at least the wet wind. You cannot land a big vessel with sails on it anywhere in there. The only way to get in there is on a small two-sailed punt with double keel that we invented. And we were able to hide on a plateau there. Thousands of people were hidden in the Murray Valley, and we were hidden in the plateau. And so we thrived. And the Scots came along and set up shore down below, just on the other side of the valley. And between the Scots and the Acadians, we developed our own type of industries there, and coal mining was one of them. And so the Baron came over from England, and he noticed there's a lot of coal here. So they sent over the British Empire and Steel Corporation to take a look at what was going on in Cape Breton, and they laid claim to everything that was Irish or French. And the British laid claim to it, and they destroyed Louisbourg, and they came in with their big ships and their guns, and they came in with their big armies, and they tracked down the Acadians and the Mi'kmaq. But they had a flaw. They could not leave their fortified places without having like 20 or 30 men. Then they had to have wagons and horses to carry their stuff. And they always left in platoons like that. And they were easy pickings for my people. So we started, and you're going to be shocked. American people, listen up. It was the Acadian people who first scalped the first British soldier. That scalp was taken and hung up on a stick and put on a horse and sent into the fortress where General Cornwallis was held up. And he was terrified of us. And we started stringing up these redcoats all up and down the coast. Okay, these people were terrified of what was happening. And now we come to the point where Cornwallis decided, well, rather than start beating these people up all the time, maybe we'll give them back a few pieces of land and we'll leave them alone again, and which he did because they had a ceremony and they're going to like this. Because it's in our language. It's in a lexicon. It's called burying the hatchet. It happened in 1769 outside of Halifax on the plains where my people said, if you don't come out here and meet us on our territory and do this symbolic gesture of burying the hatchet, then we're not going to play games. So he did come out. Cornwallis came out. They had the ceremony. There was the Treaty of 1759, which became instrumental in things to come in the future. So now we're up to the point where the British have decided that, okay, they're going to colonize more, and they're going to develop the steel and coal industries. So we're going to jump into the 1800s. They started off in my neck of the woods in a place called Low Point, which is in Cape Breton. And it's the lowest point, I guess, in the harbor of Sydney. The harbor of Sydney was used to stage all of the convoys for the First World War. Anyway, this harbor on the Low Point, my grandfather, Joe Ling, from Ireland, he came from the potato famine in the late 1800s, and he set up on Low Point, where he became the patron of the area, and he was nobody to mess around with. He was 6'4", weighed about 250, and everybody talked to Joe, and Joe knew what to do. He was an Irishman. He didn't put up with no BS. Anyway, he ran that operation. Then on the other side of the island was my other grandfather. His name was Angus Muse, and he had two brothers, Jim and Sandy. Now, these three characters, I'll call them characters because I don't like them, this was in the early 1900s, before theaters. And they had the three of them traveling around the coal mining towns here, and there were a lot of them. We had, at the time, 18 mines running. And we had two steel mills going. Everything was starting to really boom. And these guys came in from the country, and they had a minstrel show. And they used to go around town to town, the three of them, and they would do these minstrel shows in blackface. And at the time, it was an acceptable practice. And so around they go doing these things. So we had my grandfather Angus on that side, my grandfather Joe on the other side. Now, Angus was an Acadian, and he didn't like the English one little bit. And Joe was the same. He was Irish. He didn't like the English one little bit. And the two of them, they never ever met. But what they did is instrumental in what happened to me. Angus, my grandfather, they were coal miners. You know, they were short men. They were about 5'7", 5'6". They were a good build. And coal mining in Cape Breton, when you were at the wild face, you needed small, strong men. You didn't need big guys in there. You needed the right temperament. And these guys were good at what they did. They would go in and cut the stone, and chop it out, and get at the coal. And it was a big job. And they called that brushing. And so Angus and his brothers were good at what they did. Now, the First World War broke out, and they started to enlist the Canadian soldiers to fight with the Canadian regiment in the First World War. My grandfather Angus and his two brothers refused to work for the king. They refused. They said, we'll work in the pits, but we're not going to go over and kill no Germans that are just like us and probably mining coal like us. And we want to go over there and kill them? No, I don't think so. So he refused to go until the whole Newfoundland regiment was wiped out at Beaumont Hamel. In the First World War, there were hundreds and hundreds of men, some of them were relatives of my father, grandfather. So there was a request that came about May of 1917 from General Curry. He was in front of what they call Hill 61. General Curry took over for the first time ever a fighting force that had a Canadian general at the lead. And he was in charge of the Aztecs, he was in charge of the Australians and the New Zealanders, as well as the Canadians and the Fijians. And so General Curry knew that the British, for over a year and a half, had tried to take out Hill 61. They tried everything. They wore out all their tunnels. They burnt out the Samoans, they burnt out the Fijians, they burnt them all out. They had no tunnels left, and they had this tunnel boring machine that came from Scotland that only went 3 feet. It bogged down, and they couldn't get underneath Hill 61. If they didn't blow it up, they weren't getting down the line to Antwerp. So General Curry made a request, and 32 miners from Cape Breton were sent over to Halifax, and then shipped right over to France. They even had a small railroad trolley that was 3 feet in diameter across, and that was a small trolley that went over the mud and took them directly from where they came so they could get in and out without trouble because they were special. These coal miners went in, and underneath Hill 61, led by my grandfather and his compatriot, and they talked to the other miners from the other side, tapping, telling them when to get out, and they got in trouble for it. But that was all right. They did their job. They dug out the rooms underneath Hill 61, and below the rooms that they dug out, they dug another set of tunnels that came up underneath Hill 61 and up the other side so that Canadian troops could go in those tunnels when they blew it, and then they'd be already positioned on the other side to face what would be running down. So it was a remarkable strategy that they deployed and did it in 3 months. And I was told that they ran into chalk. If it was a coal miner, chalk is like having butter. This is like cutting butter. So they were like being artistic. And there's still tunnels over there where you find the chalk and names and stuff. But they blew that Hill 61. Angus and the boys were sent right back to Canada, only to land in Halifax in the greatest explosion that ever hit Nova Scotia or the Eastern Seaboard. The Halifax explosion where the two ammunition ships exploded in the harbor. Well, Cape Breton at the time, that was part of my grandfather on that side, and it's part of my heritage. I'm going to move up the line again so you can understand where I'm fitting into this stuff. In 1980, I'm going to start here because in 1980, I joined the workforce. So I didn't want to be a coal miner. Submarine coal mining is a very dangerous job. You're going 2 miles under the Atlantic Ocean. Okay? You're going down by cable. And my job was to take people down in the little boxcars down into the coal mine on the end of a cable that went 2.1 kilometers. And then I had to take it all the way back up. There were tons and tons of equipment on little boxes. The coal mining was a dangerous job. We were hired young men, and the 26 guys that were hired at the same time were hired at a time when the United Mine Workers of America were in charge of our union. And when we got hired, we wanted to know why that was. Well, why was the UNWA running the affairs of Canadian coal miners in Cape Breton? And so we had a strike for the first time in 40 years. And we expected to have a lot of strike funds. And, of course, the UNWA said, no, you don't have any. So we had to fight the strike without the help of the International Union in Washington. And when we did that, we won it, actually. We held out, but with no help from them. So I became disenchanted with the union. So did my fellow workers that were around me. And I, at the time, was drinking. And I'm sober 39 years the other day. But then I was drinking. And as drinking, coal mining, fisty cupping, womanizing, you name it. You're a coal miner and you're living in a little town in Cape Breton. I'm telling you, they ride their foot. And we had bars everywhere, like taverns and that, but they never had a union hall. And I couldn't figure that out. I say, how do we voice our, you know, like our opinions or our questions? And so I was told that they had one meeting every 2 weeks, and people would just go there, and it was controlled by rowdies and, you know, shut them down, and nothing got done. And so we decided, hey, we're going to take them on. So my buddy Archie Kennedy made a phone call, and we got an organizer in to help us, and we raided the United Mine Workers of America. And we took on the biggest, ugliest, corrupt union in the world. And we did it. We had to sign up every coal miner with a card, and we had to give us $5. That was like pulling teeth. Okay, like, you gotta get $5 and sign a card. You know, sign the card's good enough. We got to pay $5. Now they put that in there. But we did it. And we got to the vote. And of course, we thought we were going to win, but Labor Canada and the UNW, we were naive. We didn't know what we were up on. I was just getting introduced to what I was going to face. This was the beast. So we said, we're going to do this again. So we did a second raid. This time I was sober. And I was sober, and I was conscious, and the clouds had lifted, and my friends around me and everybody, we were right into it. And I became the biggest threat to the UNW of A. Richard Trumka and his goon made a special visit to Cape Breton to meet me. Well, that was an interesting meeting. Richard Trumka landed at the Sydney Airport in a private jet, and this was 1982. And in 1982, you arrive at a private jet at Cape Breton Sydney Airport, and everybody knows, because we don't usually get private jets, right? My uncle, George, got their uncles and cousins everywhere, he calls up and says, they're in town, Glenn. I said, what are you talking about? So I knew that the next morning at the pithead where I would be, handing out my leaflets, we had a gestetner, all we had, I'd be handing out our leaflets. And this, I had a friend of mine, his name was George Fraser, and he was Man Mountain Mike. If you want to think about, you know, who was that, John Henry? Anyway, he was big, but he had a lift. But you didn't mess with George. He had the list. He crushed it. You never made fun of him. But he was my bodyguard. And he's standing behind me when they get out of the limo. Richard Trumka came walking right up to me. And he put his hand out. When he put his hand out, I stick on his hand. Oh, my Lord, God Almighty. You got the two goons went for their jacket, and George grabbed one guy, threw him right over the top of me, and then had the other guy by the throat, with, just like that. And Trumka, they ran back into the car, and they took off. We never seen him again. But they sent in their hitman. They seized the district. They took the book. They canceled all the autonomy of all of the locals. They basically took over. And at that time, I withdrew my services from the coal mine, and I went to university. I said, I'm out of here, because when I woke up after being drunk for years, I decided I was going to learn. Yeah. Did you see my forehead?
Yes. Not the audience, the radio audience, but I can certainly see it, Glenn.
Okay, Jim, what you're looking at is a total frontal lobe impairment when I was 15 years old. Okay? I was working on a summer job, and I got hit with a mile hammer when I was 15 years old. And guess what had happened? It happened on the day that they said that Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. I got hit in the head working on this fence. I was dead. And they took me to the hospital. And when I got to the hospital, my mother was the emergency room supervisor in a brand new hospital that had just been built in New Waterford, where I live, by the coal miners, with a brand new operating room. And here I am dead in front of her. She brings me back to life, which is miraculous. At the same time, I was told, because I was out, that there were individuals in the emergency room that shouldn't have been there. Nobody knew who they were, but they disappeared. Dr. Nakui from India, a neurosurgeon who was right out of the McGill University, was doing his first week of residency here. What are the chances that he would be there to put me in the first induced coma that he ever did, remove the bone fragment, kept me in a coma to put a silver plate in, and told my parents that if I did come out of it, I'd probably be an idiot, like a brewer. And so everybody was preparing for the worst, and I'm at like a light. My buddy Eddie was the only one. He used to come up, sit down with the chessboard while I was there. And he played chess. He'd say the moves. He did that daily. And then he read to me the entire first book of Doom by Frank Herbert. While I was there.
Glenn, this may be the right point to take a break. We're about to hit, and I'm just fascinated by the history you're sharing here. It's really quite extraordinary. We will be taking calls at the bottom of the second hour, which will begin right after this break. Delighted to have Glenn Muse here from an exotic part of the world with an extraordinary history he is recounting for us here and now. So, stand by. We'll be right back after this break.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
Torture us and bomb us, fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet?
I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
I'm simply delighted to have Glenn Muse here from this exotic part of the world that's played an important but largely unknown role in our history, aspects of which such as burying the hatchet, the first scalp taken in North America, are extraordinary beyond belief. Glenn, please continue with your story. Bring us up to the current effort of the globalists to seize control of your area of the world and its consequences and ramifications.
Right on, Jim. I'll end with the, where I started just in the last, before the last half hour, by saying that an important part of my journey is the head injury, my revival, and subsequent a trip up into 1988. Okay, because I didn't realize that when I was brought back to life after the head injury that I was given an angel that accompanied me. And I didn't realize that until later in life. We'll get to that another time. We're going to go right now to 1988. I had formed a company, and I had training on computers. I had the first clone 286s megahertz computers on the island, so I was a novelty. So I got this company, and I got it going, and I trained a whole pile of people. And then I realized the money I was making, a pile of money. And I didn't want it, because I wanted it, but I didn't want it. It became a burden, and I got hooked up with a Jezebel, and I dropped everything, walked away, I gave the keys to the five guys I trained, and I said, I had enough of this, I'm done. I can't be a cutthroat, I just can't do it. And I ended up walking away from a woman who turned out to be a Jehovah Witness that had her hooks in me. So I had to get rid of that. So once that was out of the way, I went into a retreat, and in 1990, I was listening on the radio at night, and I was getting all this chatter at night that was coming in from George Norrie and from Art Dell and from all different places around North America, And in 1992, I received a letter from a friend of mine. And in the letter, he stated that there was a meeting in Brazil and that the Agenda 2021 at the time was being proposed, and he gave me the outline of what they were going to do. And I was shocked, because I had become educated. I'd gone to university. I'd taken 4 years in a core VA course, liberal arts program, which was a real, we had Dominican priests, we had spy there, Marcel Lavoie, he was teaching. We had a woman from Azerbaijan, she was teaching about the fall of the law. We had I was trained up the yin-yang, and I was anxious. So I decided I was going to find more out about this Agenda 21. Now, Cape Breton Island is so strategic, and I'll tell you why. Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone here in Vedette, Nova Scotia, where he's buried. Guido Marconi, under Bell's tutelage, also invented the radio here and broadcast from Table Head. Down the street from where I'm sitting, there is a beautiful little company house where a guy named Art McDonald grew up. Now, you might recognize the name, but if I told you that his name was Dr. Arthur D. McDonald and that he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2005 for discovering the neutrino. So he's responsible for CERN. Think about that. He just lived down the street. So I'm on Cape Breton. And all this is going on. And there's other things that are important about Cape Breton. Okay? To the globalists, this was the place that they wanted to show how you could deindustrialize, dehumanize, and depatriotize a citizenry and do it while they slept. And it happened. I tried to stop it. 1994, I had got involved with the people here, and they were really concerned, and so was I. So I come up with a plan. I created a character, and part of it is with the hat you see, Jim. You might want to describe the fedora. It has a little fish hook here for fly fishing, but with the fedora. And my hair was a little longer, and I had an earring, and at the time before the trench coat mafia, mind you, I had a trench coat of kangaroo hide, and I looked like a renegade, and I threw my hat into the ring for mayor of what they call the regional municipality of Cape Breton. So here we have six small towns of about 10,000 people in each small town. And every one of them are connected by the coal mines and the steel industry. Now, each one of these small towns have their own councils and their own bylaws. And there are counties that are federal that link in between there. But these small towns at the time didn't want to join into this regionalization they were proposed. And I was trying to warn them. So I got involved in the election. I got on the ballot. Now, I started on the ground campaign like nobody ever did before because we had no internet. Now, I'm on a small island of 85,000 people. The ones that are concerned about voting are the only ones that are 45,000. So that 45,000 people I had to get to are all listening to one radio show every morning at 10 a.m. called Top Back. And it reaches everybody, and people call in, you know, Top Back. So I domineered that show. Really. And I took it over, basically, and I got beat out more times than anybody. And the guy that ran it was a little egomaniac that ended up getting convicted and put in jail years later, but that's another story. But he was trying to downplay me, and he was working with the globalists to keep me off the ballot, get rid of me. So the people that were against me We have in Nova Scotia what they call Section 228, what is their communist property protection law. And if I write a letter up and I hand it to you and it says you are not permitted to step onto my property or you'll be charged. So these letters started being handed to me all over the place. At the end of it, I wasn't even allowed to walk on the sidewalk. I was banned from the coffee shop, banned from the mall. The firemen were backing me, the police were backing me. Everybody was backing me in the little town, and I was starting to move up. I was 2 weeks into it, with 2 weeks to go. And I stepped out of the boundaries of the small town called New Waterford into the county, which would be the same as if, like, you went into the town jurisdiction and you went into where a sheriff was. Well, the federal government, the RCMP, they were policing the county area. So when I left the jurisdiction of the local police, they picked me up. I was taken to jail, held incognito, given one interview with a legal aid lawyer where I wrote a statement that he read at the debate that I wasn't allowed to go to. I proposed to go in shackles, but they wouldn't take me. I was kept incognito in a holding cell for the duration of the election. They managed to stack the ballot with four more liberals, so they had six people on the ballot. I was in jail, polling at 70% on the ballot. What are they going to do if I win? Nobody in Canada has ever run for elected office from a jail cell, ever. The last guy to do that was Louis Riel, and they hung him. excuse me. Get a drink.
Sure.
So I'm in the jail, and the guards are behind me. They let me out of the so I can wander freely in the jail anywhere I want to go. Everybody in the jail, all the locals, they love me. I'm there doing bottle coke of hashish in a cell watching the returns on the TV. And they're making fun of me on the TV. And there's the polls going up. I'm up to 2,200 votes when they stop broadcasting on the local cable. And needless to say, they stacked the ballot and they declared John Cody the winner. And they never released the total ballots until a couple of days later. But I beat out a hand-picked liberal from a jail cell. See, they couldn't get rid of that because it was too overwhelming. So they had to put that in. But they spent $500,000 trying to keep me out of the mayor's chair. And they did it successfully. And then I was labeled. And then I was pushed into a position where I had to put myself in exile to Halifax, 500 kilometers away, because it became unbearable here. And my family, they were shitting all over them, so I had to get out of here. So we got to move along and up to, they started with their program. Here's what they do. First, they take over the local council and the school board. And they regionalize everything. They regionalize the school boards. They regionalize the hospitals. They regionalized all of the townships and counties. Everybody reports to one central authority. There's no way to communicate with any of these government agencies for the simple fact that the boards are taken away, so there's no way to get to them except through written communication. They have complete control over the media. There is nobody here on this island who can make a statement about what's happening in the government, because the regionalization process has gotten to the point where we lost all of our coal mines are gone, all of the railroad is gone, they've taken out all of the steel plant was sold to China, everything that was here that was industrial has disappeared. We are now have only a sentient population of pensioners and service industries that are basically paid for by the government. Everything is communist. You work for the hospital, You work for the school board. You work for industries that are reliant on the government. You work in service, and all of it, social service, all of it. There are some small enterprises, but they're all linked together in this enterprise network. So they're not really. This is the word I'm looking for, Jim, is communitarianism. It's a blending. That's communism with economics to the left, not to the fascist, neo-fascist side. We're talking more to the middle neoliberal communitarianism, and it's being taught at Harvard by the Zionists. And so this is what's encapsulated Cape Breton. And now we get to the big part. Right to the north of Cape Breton is Newfoundland. And Newfoundland is another province that only joined in 1949, similar to Alaska, right? And Newfoundland joined Canada, and but it was an independent state, basically, before World War II. When World War II occurred, the Americans came in to Stephenville, Newfoundland. And they set up the biggest naval base, airfield, and underground tunnel networks in all of North America. And they're still there. Okay? You could park a sub in the harbor and go right in. You think about Antarctica, and they got all that crap going on down there. Well, you think about Stephenville, Newfoundland. Now, the air base can hold, and it was the biggest air base before the Second World War. All of your transports, all of your stuff that went to the World War effort flew through Stephenville. Okay? Now, 8 weeks ago, Chinese Jewish company called Diamond blocked the Stephenville airport. All communication with Stephenville has been cut off. I can't reach anyone. There's a population of 10,000 people, but I can't, even when I call the church, it's an answering machine. You can't get there because there's only one road from Fort Bass, where the ferry lands, because you can get to Newfoundland by ferry. There's only one road going into Stephenville. And guess what? The atmospheric river that we had there, what, a few months ago, wiped out that highway. At the same time, someone that you may know that appears with David Zubek, John Conrad, John Drake, he monitored flights for me on a program where you could see what flights and the tail numbers, and MonkeyWorks is looking now too, but we got three flights from the UAE landing at Stephenville Airport every week. What the hell? So, in Sydney, where I'm sitting, we have what is called a radar dome. And it's been here since 1953. And underneath that radar dome, which is supposed to be decommissioned, but it's not, underneath that radar dome, we have all of the underground cables coming in from Europe, from fiber that's come in from Europe. All the cables come into Cape Breton, they leave Point Michelle, and they go directly to the eastern seaboard of the U.S. Now, we're sitting on top of all that activity. There's seven levels below this radar base that they actually added to, because part of my story in another time will be about the nonprofit that took over the base to put a facade of housing there, but the military still go there in plain clothes. And they go into this structure, and the deep underground tunnels are hooked up 45 miles away to the Bell Estate, which is up into that. And again, down to Point Michelle, and all of this activity is all here in Cape Breton. Okay? And the whole world is looked up everywhere else while the Chinese are setting up right over on your back doorstep. They practice how to take out medical systems. They did that in Newfoundland about 2 months ago. They ran a simulation. So they're going to use that as part of taking out the rest of Canada probably next. Well, right here in Communist Canada, and we are communist now, the Stephenville Newfoundland Airport is the base and it's a jumping off point. And here we're so docile that now that the population here is not aware, not even the slightest. They think that dome up there is decommissioned and nobody asks questions. So the globalists have determined that Cape Breton is a part of their protective environment. We have not had one COVID death here. 3 years. But yet we have a hospital that is for 7 years in a row the highest death rate in all categories for the whole country of Canada, socialized medicine. And in that socialized medicine network, there's a group of people that the globalists have put here that are running riot and they're decimating the healthcare, especially killing the old people here. We have an average of 10 people a day since January. At a population base of 45,000, a lot of people, and I complain about it, and they stick all the hobs of hell have come after Glenn News again. They tried to evict me from the house I built here to treat people with mental illness. I've been here treating people for 15 years. I've been doing it on my own nickel. I don't get it paid from anybody. God provides for me, and I provide for people he sends. This house was a crack house. I raised 200 grand. I refurbished it. I took a pledge to Our Lady of Fatima. And I started providing support and help. And then they tried to kill me 3 times. The last time, I had taken a massive heart attack. I believe it was a directed energy attack. It blew me by life flight 500 clicks away. Performed emergency surgery. Blew me back here. They anticipated that I would die. But I came back and I actually jumped out of the ambulance. I jumped out of the ambulance. Now you think about that. Now, I'm in the hospital, signed my release papers, and I came home. And I got on my bed, and I said, I'm going to recuperate. So that the adrenaline I needed to do that act really took its toll. And so I needed to lay down and rest. So I'm here in the house, and people that are the property managers are trying to get me out. So the construction crew shows up the next morning, and for 3 weeks, they hammered, nailed, and sawed above me, sending me back into the hospital. I'm fortunate that I have a doctor who's also a psychiatrist, and he's a good friend. And you know how rare that is. I don't know if people understand that, but if I didn't have this man in my life right now, I'd be dead. That's how serious this is. We had one doctor who gave me a prescription, and I have all the evidence. Everything I tell you is documented. I have FOIA requests. I have everything. I learned this from Jim Fetzer years ago about keeping track of things. And I've been doing it my whole life since Sandy Hook and since then. I have all this documentation, and they're trying to get me out of here again. But now the police are involved. This doctor made a prescription out. And I took it to the pharmacy, and they should have flagged it, because they didn't. And when I came home, I took some of this. I thought it was for my throat. You have to see how raspy it is. And it turned out to be what is called Epipax syrup. You should look it up, because if you take just a drop of this on your tongue, you immediately go into convulsions and throwing up. And if you had nothing on your stomach, you continue to convulse. I was on the floor for 2 days. Nobody came here. And when I got out of that, I went to the police. They wouldn't investigate. I got the documents. The police chief, his name is Peter McCosick. When I launched the investigation into the hospital and produced documents of malfeasance, he had to retire because his wife works there. Now we have a new chief, Robert Walsh. Woke. So I'm taking him to task, and we're going to have really some good information in the next few weeks as I play with these people, because they're all mental midgets, and I'm still here. I'm sitting here talking to you. I have an angel that is takes care of me. I have no fear. Fear is not in my vocabulary. I think I was scared one time. It was a bear. It was a bear, and I was up working on a power line, and I stared him down. So maybe I don't have fear. I worked in a coal mine. I was buried. It took them an hour to get me. Get this. When the coal line, when the belt line broke, it was carrying tons and tons of coal to the surface. And it flooded me, and it picked me up, and it pushed me up this tunnel. And as it was pushing me, it pushed me into what they call a manhole. It's a telephone booth-sized hole where you can jump off the tracks, not get hit. So there I ended up getting saved again. So I have an angel.
Glenn,
I'm going to leave it at that, I guess, Ken.
Glenn, this has been a fascinating story. I want everyone to know the lines are open for callers. The number 540-352-4452, 540-352-4452. For questions for Glenn Muse or for me, whether they're about the January 6th event and the Democrats' effort to try to preclude Trump from running again because of their anxiety he will once again clean their clock, or the more fascinating personal story Glenn's been sharing, call us. We'll get you on the line, 540-352-4452. We await your call.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
This is your host, Jim Fetzer, on The Raw Deal with my special guest, Glenn Muse. We have a caller from the 412 area code. Caller, please just give your first name and your state and join the conversation.
Oh, hi, this is Mike from Pennsylvania.
Excellent.
Hey, I didn't really have a question for your guest, but I was just wondering if you knew much about Fauci and his Grady in-laws and their connections to the Bush family.
Oh, that's a great question. I'm hoping to actually publish on that. This is a fascinating subject, and I'm delighted you raised the question. So let me just say the answer to that will be forthcoming, hopefully as early as this weekend. Did you want to elaborate yourself on why, what drives you to raise the question?
Just a hobby of mine to look into these things and try and figure out why Tony Fauci, you know, hasn't been removed and why he hasn't been uncovered for his lie about HIV, you know, not causing AIDS. So.
Now, No, these are great questions, Mike. As I understand it, his wife actually is either with the FDA or is even the resident ethicist at the NIH. Do you know which is which? It seems to me there's a bit of nepotism going on here and potentially an enormous conflict of interest. Either way, your thoughts?
I believe she was the bioethicist at the NIH. But there's a really interesting fact because she has a brother who, when all the funding was being created for HIV/AIDS, was staffing for George Herbert Walker Bush. Her brother, Robert E. Grady.
Which ties in the Bush family here in the background. And no doubt, the Carlyle Group and perhaps other of these mega entities that have such phenomenal assets and no doubt are exploiting the pandemic and the vax for every nickel they can extract from it. Would you agree, Mike?
I would agree. In fact, her brother was a partner at the Carlyle Group.
Her brother was a partner at the Carlyle. It's interesting you mentioned a bioethicist. There's a fellow at NYU that I knew years ago when we were both on the faculty at the University of Minnesota, where he was on the Twin Cities campus, I on the Duluth, by the name of Arthur Kaplan, Breitbart recently reported that he has declared that those who are unvaxxed should be denied health insurance. I mean, this is so outrageous. It's as though he knows nothing of the facts of the matter, of the risks posed by the vaccine, of the staggering death rate, of the number and variety of injuries. Indeed, I was so incensed that I wrote to the administration with a copy to him explaining that this was completely irresponsible and that he either did not know enough to be taking a stand or was completely corrupt by not offering a balanced opinion, because in his position as a bioethicist, he's expected to be in a position to comment on public policy. The idea, if he knows that the vax is a lethal weapon, that he should promote coercing those who have been unvaccinated to become vaccinated by the threat of otherwise removing their health insurance is completely outrageous. And if he doesn't know, then he's clearly disqualified from his position because he literally does not know what he's talking about. I was very surprised when, after my initial submission, he responded to me, this is an exercise of free speech, because in my letter to the administration, I'd explained I'd be glad to offer further detailed evidence in support of my position by request. So when he replied and said, you know, free speech, I went about laying out the whole lot of the evidence, the hockey stick, that we'd have virtually no deaths up until the coronavirus vaccine, and then it shot upward. Data from the World Health Organization, from the CDC, how we now have insurance companies reporting a 40% increase between the ages of 18 and 65 working age people, 40% increase. That if it were only a 10%, it would be a 1 in 200-year phenomenon, that 40% is completely unheard of. And then he came back and said, that my colleagues know that's all nonsense. So I gave another round, including two studies I'd done on the pandemic, where I have been following this and reporting on it virtually every single day since March of 2020. So, Mike, these bioethicists seem to me, they're in a vital position, but they don't appear to be upholding their responsibility. And if she is, if the wife of Fauci is in that position at the NIH, I regard that as completely outrageous and inappropriate. One or the other ought to be removed. Frankly, Fauci has no business in government service. He's going to go down in history as the greatest mass murderer of all time for inducing people to take the jab, which is going to decimate millions. I believe as many as 15 million have already died. And the objective, of course, is to take out a vast or larger proportion of the world's population. Your further comments, Mike?
I would just say that, you know, I believe everything you say. And in this day and age, reality and truth just seems to get pushed aside from the fairy tale narratives that these people have. In 76, when David Sensor and the CDC injured all the people for the swine flu, that's what his comment was to that was, it was proved there was no deadly virus. They were wrong. And he said, well, if there had been, all the deaths that I caused by, you know, the vaccine and all the Guillain-Barré syndrome, you know, paralysis would have seemed like just a blip. And vaccines would have been held as a miracle, you know, for curing people. But instead, they injured everybody.
Yeah, that's hardly an apology or an excuse, it seems to me. That's just ridiculous. Fauci and colleagues did a study on the Spanish flu, and they discovered the overwhelming majority did not die from the flu, but rather from bacterial pneumonia infections in their lungs that turn out to be promoted by wearing masks. So the masks are a way of killing us slowly, the vaccines killing us more rapidly, and then I believe they're going to clean the clock by using, yeah, here's a book, Nova Scotia and the Great Influenza Pandemic, 1918 to 1920, that my guest.
Breaking news.
Breaking
news, 1918. Again, Cape Breton is in the middle of it, a troop ship with 400 soldiers coming from the United States landed in Sydney, everyone vaccinated, everyone sick. They came into Sydney, and the Spanish flu spread from Cape Breton westward from these soldiers, Jim.
And, of course,
I got the book, the woman researched it, and we have all the news clippings from the time, and I'll tell you, every one of these soldiers, the majority of them infected hundreds of nurses.
Get this. Mitchell has just posted. The Supreme Court, which is hearing arguments over vaccine mandates, displayed a stunning lack of knowledge of basic COVID-19 facts during today's oral argument. The worst offender, Justice Sotomayor, who not only claimed there are 100,000 children in serious condition with many on ventilators, there are 3,342, according to Health and Human Services, with many or most being incidental COVID positives alongside other conditions, but that Omicron is as deadly as Delta. In other words, she doesn't know what she's talking about. I mean... This is absolutely stunning. This is our Supreme Court, and they're ignorant of what's going on here. Shocking. Mike Moore, perhaps in response to what Glenn has added to the mix.
Moore. It's true. I believe the vaccinations are causing the deaths. All of people vaccinated in 1918 were the ones that died from the Spanish flu, if that's what it was. And now they're forcing the vaccinations, and they're the people that are going to have autoimmune disease, which is Tony Fauci's specialty. That's what he did. In the early 70s, he was studying autoimmune disease caused by flu vaccines. And then he used chemo drugs to suppress their immune system and, you know, kind of cure them. It's no cure. It's a masking of the symptoms. But that's what he's doing. He took that to AIDS and used the deadly chemo drug AZT to kill millions of people.
I think you're right, and that Bobby Kennedy makes a similar point to wit that Fauci is using the same techniques he used to scam the public over AIDS and HIV again with a COVID. Glenn, your thoughts?
Yeah, look, I have something to add to that. Yeah, dude, I coined the term. I put it up on Twitter. D-A-I-D-S, vaccine-induced immune deficiency. And it, within an hour, I don't even use Twitter, but there was like about 400 people came back. So VAIDS is going to be a real thing. And here in Cape Breton, and I'm going to stress it again, nobody died from COVID here. They're all dying from the vaccine. And my neighbor, I got a film up on my YouTube channel, Glenn News. You can go there and watch me. I have an EMS team in my house where I revived my neighbor from after the second Moderna shot. I had to perform CPR. I filmed the EMS team when they came in, and I put it up. It was after her second Moderna shot. I had my antibody test done, paid $400. I had COVID 2020. My antibody test came back, 425 versus your 35% with vaccine hesitancy or resistance. So there you go.
Mike Moore.
Yeah, you know, when you get into the test for COVID, the PCR and things like T-cell counts, you know, they're all, once again, they fudge the numbers. They tell you strange things. So the PCR test, you know, testing for antibodies for AIDS, showing that you were resistant to it, was a complete, you know, misuse of science. And now it's all false positives with the PCR test, again, for COVID. But can I just say this? So you're talking about Christine Grady being a bioethicist. Her father went to Yale with George Herbert Walker Bush. They graduated in the same class together in 1948. So, you know, when I talk about the ties, George Herbert Walker Bush probably knew all of the Grady kids. Christine Grady, the bioethicist, her brother that wrote speeches for him and staffed for him in 87, her brother that worked at the DOJ, and, her sister that married a State Department official, they all know the Grady family. And that's how tied in Bush or Fauci is then to these Grady families.
Well, I think that's a very, very searching background, just as Glenn has been giving us a stunning history of his neck of the woods. Glenn, further thoughts here in response to Mike's comments.
Yeah, in regards to the Bush legacy and the people that have been tied to different other bloodlines, I would have to say that on recent research, when you put a picture of Betty White up next to a picture of Barbara Bush, and you put a picture of Aleister Crowley up, they're going to be shocked. Okay? Betty White controlled all of Hollywood for all of these years. Barbara Bush controlled all of the political factions. All of these bloodlines all come together. Okay? Betty White, everybody loved Betty White. I know that everybody loves her. Funny, funny, funny lady. But you better look into her background. Tell me right now.
Well, that's very interesting, Glenn. Betty White just celebrated her birthday, for which she got a booster, and now she's dead. They're not admitting it, but it was a booster that killed her. I have no doubt she was in great health. She was boasting about her great health and that she just got a booster. And now look at the fate she has incurred. There's a stunning correlation between the increase in the use of the vaccines and the deaths that are dying here. They're not from the corona pandemic. They're not from the alleged pandemic. That led to no increase in death in any category. But the use of these vaccines is stunning. And as Mitchell's reporting now, if the Supreme Court is oblivious of the facts of the matter, they could make incredibly stupid decisions here based upon their profound ignorance. This is the height of irresponsibility. What in God's name do we have these institutions for if they're going to be staffed by morons who don't bother to do research and base their decisions on fake news and false beliefs? I'm telling you, Mike, we're in a disgusting situation here in the United States.
Very much so. It's horrible. You know, Betty White, I've never looked into her, but as you say the name, the White family has many members in the Yale Skull and Bones. I've never checked to see if she was from that line. Did you hear about the New York Times editor, Carlos Tejada, who made a video, you know, telling people they were pricks if they did not get the vaccine and then died the next day?
Died after having got the jab, no doubt. I mean, you know, there's a certain irony. Unfortunately, all these sources that many regard to be authoritative are giving bad information and advice that's going to lead to massive death on a scale unprecedented right here in the USA, not to mention on a worldwide scale. It's stunning.
Snopes says that the Betty White getting the booster is fake. I tried to look it up, but, you know, they all swear that there was no correlation, that she didn't even have a booster.
No, but she announced it in a tweet. I've got a copy of it. It's going to be in my show today, I think. I need to know it later today. There's no doubt she had the booster. She was announcing she had the booster. They just have to rush. You know, it's like the little Dutch boy trying to put his finger in the holes in the dike. There are just too many holes springing. The dike is about to split open. I think that the horrors of the vaccination are being concealed by individuals who are trying to suppress the facts of the matter. You mentioned her at NIH, and I mentioned Arthur Kaplan at NYU. They are a disgrace to their profession, and they're betraying every principle of ethics that they ought to be upholding, the most fundamental of which is always treat other persons with respect and never merely as a means. What the Rothschilds are doing, of course, is killing people willy-nilly, treating people as means is manifest in kidnapping, robbery, rape, burglary. You're merely using someone else as a means to advance your own interests, and of course, wholesale genocide, you could not find a more stunning example, which Fauci is promoting in some of these self declared ethicists are covering for. I mean, you know, to say that a certain person who refuses to get the vax because they know it's killing and maiming huge numbers of people, even by the CDC and WHO's own data, that they should be denied health insurance is about as outrageous as it gets. Mike.
Well, you know, I think they have or feel like they're doing work for the government, because it all goes back for me to 1974 with the National Security Study Memo written by Rockefeller and Kissinger that stated they wanted to depopulate 13 lesser developed countries so that the U.S. could dominate them and their natural resources. And that program is what I believe set off the 76 swine flu. And I think they're using vaccinations and poisonous medicine and all that. And people like Christine Fauci are part of this operation, and therefore they're doing what they can to promote it. And if that means saying you're a bioethicist and then lying to people when you know the vaccinations are going to injure you, that's what they're doing. I think they feel like depopulating the earth is the greater good.
Well, Glenn, you seem to be going through a mini version of this, right, on your little island. And, you know, you're observing no one has died from COVID, but a staggering number are now dying after taking the vax. I mean, that's a nice, clear, isolated example that seems to me a perfect illustration for scientific comparative purposes. Your thoughts?
It is a petri dish, Jim. It's something similar to Israel, only they haven't. What they did was they implemented the 85-15 rule. Well, I worked for Janssen for a short period of time on a contract in 1990. I was given a contract to distribute Imodium, which was for diarrhea, which is a good drug, and it was needed. And the other drug was called Hisminol. And Hisminol was an allergy medication, and it had a suspension for children, which worked really, really good. But the adult version caused heart attacks. So, but after the 6-month trial, it was an 85-15 here. 85% of the drug was a placebo, and 15% of the drug distributed were the actual drugs. The same thing is occurring with the vaccines here. You have people running around saying, I got the vaccine and I feel great. Nothing wrong. So they're part of the 85 that are promoting the drug inadvertently without knowing it. And the 15 that are dying, the 15% of the people that are dying are all subjected to different levels. Now, I have a first cousin, and you should be on good terms with your undertaker, because he's the last one that'll ever let you down. And my first cousin, Kenny, he runs two funeral homes here. And I call him up regularly, and I keep an eye on the stats. He has not had to wear PPEs any time, neither have the police or the firemen or the EMS workers, and he has not had one death or COVID or associated. All the deaths are associated with heart, lungs, and an upsurge in cancers that had been eliminated a couple of years ago. They have come back with ferocity. That's what's happening here. And so I go down to the grocery store. Now, my main objective here in Cape Breton is to reduce the fear of the seniors that are locked down. I have several friends that are locked down, Jim. In one nursing home is called McGilvery's. They have 108 residents that last year when the outbreak occurred in March, I supplied them with a laptop computer, a full HD projector, a full screen, and a Bluetooth speaker system. I had it delivered to the nursing home. They had nothing. Now, there is a video that I could give to you, show you the news report on that, but it took away the fear from that nursing home. And that's the way I deal with things here. And now I go downtown to the grocery store today, and I take with me 5 N95 masks, and I keep them in my bag. And when I see a senior who's really panicked, I'll go over and talk to them, and I'll tell them that this will never let them get sick. So they think that the N95 now is going to reduce their chances of getting Omicron. Now, I know that's off the radar, But that's how I deal with the seniors. You cannot break them with a red pill. You got to comfort them. You got to comfort these people because we're locked down here. My friend Wayne is over there, and they got him locked in a room for 2 years. 2 years? I can't even get in the building. I sent them a flat screen with a memory stick with 30 gigs of documentaries, and you're on it, Jim, and a few other people. And he's in there with his screen in that room, and I go ahead.
No, this is very good. Michael.
I don't know what else to say. It's hard. I don't believe that the masks and the separation, of course, do any good at all. People should be going about their normal daily life, and if people get sick, then they should be getting the best care. Vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, and everything else, ivermectin. But
it was indicative of the maliciousness of the campaign that they suppress these drugs, HCQ and ivermectin, that would have saved millions of lives. They had to suppress it because they could only get emergency use authorization if there were no available alternatives. So as long as ivermectin and HCQ were available, they could therefore not get emergency use authorization, which also enables them to withhold the contents of the drug. So this was very cleverly contrived. Those who are studying the drugs now, the contents include all kinds of weird parasites. They include graphene oxide. They include other elements that are going to dramatically alter the life of those to whom the injections are given, especially in terms of wiping out their immune system. And as you observe, this is the area in which Anthony Fauci is one of the world's leading experts. I therefore believe Fauci was the tip of the spear in producing the entire event. There's a parallel here with 9/11. Philip Zelikow was made the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. I believe Philip Zelikow actually wrote the script for 9/11. His area of expertise before he entered that role was the creation and maintenance of public myths, MYTHS. So here you have Anthony Fauci leading the cheerleading squad for taking the vax when he appears to me to have been the one who designed the whole devious plot to make this come about at the behest of the Rothschild banking industry, Klaus Schwab, Bill Gates, and a host of other miscreants who are out to dramatically reduce the world's population. We're here at the end. Glenn Hughes, I can't thank you enough. Mike, this was a terrific phone call. This is Jim Fetzer wishing you all a great weekend and spend as much time as you can with your family and friends, because we do not know how much time we have left.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Como va? This is Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. I pulled some strings and gotten you front row seats to my new show, The Perfect Triangle, live Friday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Revolution Radio Studio A. The Perfect Triangle is equilateral, three sides of the same length. In an angry, bipolar world, three perfect sides reveal many truths.
Body, mind, and spirit.
Thought, word, and deed.
Conspiracy, propaganda, and truth.
Natural health, allopathic tyranny, and your body.
Freedom, globalism, and sovereign nations.
And so much more. Each week, the Perfect Triangle will blast through fake news lies, champion the natural way and natural law, unravel the Orwellian deceptions of our corrupt government, reveal the satanic evil of globalist banks and transnational corporations. Tune in every Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, to Revolution Radio Studio A for thoughtful discussions with free thinkers. Your calls are always welcome. The Perfect Triangle, the perfect triangle with perfect Giuseppe triangle, perfect from the District of Criminals. Join me, won't you?
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict. But